Heavenly Father, we thank you for this precious Son of yours. We ask you now to fill him with your Holy Spirit and give him your words for us. Give us ears to hear and bless him in the doing of it as well, in Jesus' name.
We're going to talk about contemporary society. I've got only about 15 slides, and then we're going to do some interaction today, which is really, really important. And on the 6 points, biblical points on authentic sexuality, which has been handed out for you, I'm picking up on number 3, which is, you know, that we're born with an innate capacity for sex. And number 4, that sex and spirituality are closely linked. And then number 5 is that after the fall, is that it became distorted. And many of us have experienced and struggled with broken sexuality, broken relationship issues. It is rife in our culture. And one of the tragedies, I think, for contemporary culture is that we have a whole heap of issues that perpetuate that, that keep that going on. And we're going to talk a bit about that. I want to just remind you that, you know, what happens is that when we're dealing with cultural issues, we're dealing with post-fall issues. And Philip Yancey, I think, is right when he says, the church is to be the conscience of society. The church has to be the conscience of society. Now, this is tricky because how do we actually be a conscience that pricks people without being judgmental and condemning? And unfortunately, we've left it to the denomination and the denominational leaders to tackle government on issues rather than actually having a groundswell of individuals who say, I'm a voter and I actually want to ask questions about this, or I don't like this, or as my member of parliament, I want you to know that this is my opinion. And within today's technology, you know, you can send an email to your parliamentarian within 30 seconds. But most of us don't. And there are really important social issues for us to confront. Now, before I get into that, one of the problems is we talked about sexual theology yesterday, and one of the problems is language. Because over here we've got the Puritans who say don't use any language, don't talk about sex. Sex is something you don't talk about. And on the other end, we've got the pornographers. Hope you like the picky there. We have the pornographers who say, let's talk about it and let's make it as crass and obscene as we want. And then the question is, there's a void in the middle, is that how do we as Christians engage in talking about social issues of sexuality when, as growing up in the church, we have a Puritan approach where we don't talk about it and we don't want to use the language of the pornographers? How do we wrestle that? And yesterday there was a few laughs when I read from Proverbs 5, and then I, you know, gave you a little bit about the gazelle wanting to go to the garden. There is a way of talking about this stuff without going either end. And we need to have to discover that. But you know what? For most of us, we're actually going to be embarrassed when we first start talking about this. If we start talking to our sons and our daughters, even if we start talking to our wives, we're going to have a tinge of embarrassment. And my reply is, get over yourself. Because this is really important. And in fact, one of the hardest topics to talk about in marriage is to talk with your wife about what you want sexually in a non-demanding way. To be able to go, sweetheart, this is the desire of my heart sexually. What's the desire of your heart? I wonder, don't put your hand up, I wonder how many of you have actually had that conversation. And we'll talk about how you can do that constructively to get a result, okay? Okay? Okay, we will do that as well, all right? But getting a language is really, really important, and not feeling like, you know, I'm actually going to slip into the pornographers, but actually getting a language to talk about sexuality in a way. And, you know, I remember preaching in my church probably 15 years ago, maybe even 20 years ago, and it was on sex. And one of the ladies who was younger than me in the church, she said, how do people respond to the S-E-X word? And I thought, get over it. You know? And, you know, when I do sex eds in schools, one of the schools I'm known at, I used to be called the sex man. Now I'm called Puberty Pete. Isn't that great? They don't think I know. They don't think I know. It's so much fun. And people say, oh, you're so direct. And I go, why not? Why not? Turn on the TV, go to any video hits show, they're direct, aren't they? And if we're not direct to count it, then we grow up where people have a moral void because they've got nothing to count what they're being bombarded with. Okay. Next concept I just want to talk about is I want to revisit a little bit from last year and add a bit to it where I'm going to talk about authentic masculinity just for a moment because this is a really, really important issue. So last year when we did Being a Bloke, we talked about that the real deal Aussie bloke is strength in action with character, and this is, remember, the archetype. This is the male symbol, which is the warrior god Mars, and the round bit is his shield, and the erect bit is his spear, a symbol of strength. So the real deal bloke is strong, and he takes action, but he doesn't take action for himself. It's about character. It's about the greater good of the community. And I used Lord of the Rings as an illustration, and in the Fellowship of the Ring are this group of blokes, all different shapes and sizes, all different gifts and talents, and they learn to be authentic blokes and fight a cause to save Middle Earth, something bigger than themselves. Then we also talked about that there were the pretenders. And the pretenders were in the other three diagrams on the right there. So the first pretender was the passive bloke, which was the Peter Pan man. You know, he's immature, he's insecure. He has no strength. He's the perpetual little boy. He marries a mother figure that he can occasionally have sex with. He doesn't want to take responsibility and act. The second one is the modern day eunuch, or in bloke parlance, the limp dick. And he's impotent. And I don't mean sexually impotent. He actually chooses to take no action. He's the guy that, you know, he breaks out into a hot sweat when he's walking to a door with a woman who's a pretty strong woman. Will I open the door and be called a chauvinist? Or will I not open the door and be called inconsiderate? At Easterfest in Toowoomba, we did a session, Richard, one of my associates and I, we did a session on a bit about chivalry. And we talked about, you know, stepping up. And in the group, there must have been about 60, 70 blokes, and half of them were teenagers. And we talked about stepping up, and three blokes said to me later, these young guys said, thank you. They said, you know, I used to open doors, but the girls gave me a hard time. And I said, so why are you going to let a woman determine what you do, are you? Maybe if you open the door and she's got a problem with it, maybe it's her problem, not yours. Why should you own that? And these three young guys looked me in the eyes and shook my hand and said, thank you, Peter, I know what I'm going to do now. Simple things. When I walk with Neroli beside the road, is that, you know, chivalry says you should walk closest to the curb. I do that. It's automatic these days. I learned a lot from my father-in-law that when he would drop friends of ours home, he'd wait until they were inside before he drove off. Just very simple things. But what happens is that we've got these blokes who don't take action. Then we've got the arrogant bloke who's got strength, but he's got no character. And what we see is that we see some blokes kicking goals at work, and then they come home and check out and be the limp dick or the little boy. And then their wives are frustrated. And I talked about this last year, about the work of Pierre Monel from his book, Passive Men, Wild Women, is that these guys kick goals at work, come home, check out, and their wives get really angry because they know the best of us and they want the best of us, but we don't give it to them. And then we've got the real deal bloke. Now, I want to put to you that one of the struggles that we have in our culture with sexuality is actually comes out of the three pretenders. There's a war. I remember Mel Gibson when he was interviewed around The Passion, and he said to the 60 Minutes interviewer, there's a war, there's a spiritual war in the unseen world. And the interviewer said, what's the war about? And he said, it's over you and me. See, there's a war that says the enemy doesn't want us to be authentic, real-deal blokes. So the quickest way is to make us one of the pretenders. Now, that affects us directly, but also the essence of feminine sexuality affects us directly as blokes. And I'm going to talk about that. So, the female symbol is from the god Aphrodite. Aphrodite was just born a hot babe. She was never ever a child or a teenager. She was just a hot babe, and she never grew old. She was just a hot babe. And that's her mirror. The round bit is a mirror, and the down bit is a handle, and where she could hold her mirror and look into her face and behold her beauty. But when you look into a mirror that's only this big and you see your face, you see the eyes, which are the light of the soul. So it's about inner beauty. So it's about women being confident, being compassionate, having compassion, but it's about inner beauty. And let me tell you, blokes, I'm yet to meet a woman that doesn't have a longing for a man to look her in the eyes and see her beauty. And to look her in the eyes and go, boy, you're gorgeous. Every woman longs for that. But our women also have a whole heap of pretenders. In fact, they've got an extra pretender than the blokes. So let me tell you about the pretenders for the women. The first one is the plain Jane, which she doesn't want to have any sexuality or femininity. And in the movie, Never Been Kissed, portrays that really, really well. Then we have the seductress, which is best portrayed by Desperate Housewives. This is these women, they've got shallow confidence because it's all about seductive beauty. You know, they dress themselves up and they're going to seduce men and use their sexuality as power and a tool, but it actually doesn't meet their need. Then the next one is the caricature. And it's very intentional that Barbie up there and Lara Croft is up there because it is, you know, lots of confidence, but there's no capacity and it's all external beauty. But you know what? It's a caricature. Lara Croft was voted in the top 10 sexiest women in the world. She's not a woman. She's an animation. That says something about our world, doesn't it? And Barbie, who's the same age as me, the year that Barbie was made was that Ruth Handler was looking for a doll that she could market, and she was in Germany and she found a cartoon strip, which was a porno strip of a character called Lil. And she took that, and that became the base for Barbie. And every one of the girls in the world who played with Barbie, the model of Barbie came from a porno doll. But as I say to kids all the time, Barbie's just skin-thin plastic, hollow on the inside. And Ken's even more shallow because he says, come on, Barbie, let's go party. But our girls grow up thinking that that's what a real woman is. And in fact, if Barbie was real, she'd have to walk around on all fours because her anatomy is that her breasts are so big that she wouldn't be able to hold up her weight and stand up properly because it's so disproportionate. The last one is the radical feminist. And those who were here last year saw the clip from Jermaine Greer on Q&A, and we had that lovely gasp about the things that she said where she declared that she's a Marxist. And so there's no... beauty is just not part of the deal. There's this whole disregard for femininity and masculinity. We've just got to be an amorphous bunch. And then we have the authentic woman who's the real deal. And unfortunately in our culture is that the sexualization of our girls and our women is that, you know, it's all skin deep beauty. That's all it's about. And so if we take the pretenders of the blokes and what our culture says about the pretenders of the women, you can see that the post-fall stuff plays out where there's so much pretense, not much transparency, not much authentic intimacy. And that becomes the battleground. Does that make sense? So let me change tack for a moment and I'm going to just talk a little bit about sexuality and sex so we just get some understanding about this. I want to say that there are two facets basically to sex. There's above the waterline and below the waterline. Above the waterline is what's called genital sex, which is about bodies. So it's about techniques and sensations. So the focus often on this is about what I do. It's about how I feel, how I get off, what we do. And our culture says, take two beautiful bodies, do contortionist things, and you have amazing sex. That's genital sex. But human sexuality is so different to animal sex that it's actually more complicated because there's stuff under the water, which is about holistic sex. So it's about the connection, not just of our bodies, but our emotions, our mind, our relationship, our spirituality, about my whole being. And so therefore now this is about tone and depth and meaning. And so sex is laden with meaning. And when I talk about social issues and guys who are struggling with sexual brokenness, I often want to talk about the meaning. I don't want to talk about the behaviour because this is about who I am. There's a meaning attached to it. And the battle in sexual brokenness is about changing the meaning. But the battle about sexual fulfillment and sexual wholeness is also a battle of meaning. Now, for the young guys, I want you to check out, if you're here with your dad or someone you trust, I want you to check out what I'm saying here and ask him if it's true, because what this leads to is mercy sex. And mercy sex is where you go through the motions and you might reach orgasm and get off, but it's not get the best sex at all. It's like drive-through McDonald's, wang, bam, thank you, ma'am. And then underneath that, we've got meaningful connected sex. That's profoundly spiritual. When you actually have got connected to your wife and it's like, man, oh man, I just want to be with this person. And it's not about orgasm. It's not about techniques. It's actually about the meaningful connection. And every married couple knows the difference between mercy sex and meaningful connected sex, because sadly we end up with a lot of mercy sex and not enough meaningful connected sex. And probably you get more meaningful connected sex when you've been married 20, 30, 40 years. But it doesn't have to be that way. So you young guys who are single, please grab a married guy and check him out. Don't take what I'm saying as truth. Grab him and say, was PJ talking about mercy sex? Was that true? Okay? And one of the issues is that the contemporary issues of our culture are generating more and more mercy sex. So I hook up with you and have sex because it's all exciting and new, and once it loses its numinous and excitement and doesn't do it for me, then I mustn't love you anymore, so I need to go find somebody else that's all exciting and new and hook up, and that gives me all, you know, adds to the eroticism and adds to all the fun, and when that doesn't do it, then I must go to the next one. And so now we have, before marriage, the most common relationship in Australia is serial monogamy, where I go from one relationship to another relationship to another relationship. And they never, ever plummet the depths of human sexuality because they keep it as just about bodies and getting off. Does that make sense? Okay. Next slide I'm going to talk about is, because I'm building so we get some understanding when we come to talk about social issues. I'm going to say it's plummeting because it's like the depth of intimacy and knowing is a bottomless pit that you never reach. So it's like the more I connect with Neroli and the more I go into her soul, the deeper she goes, the deeper I go, the more meaningful the connection is.
Fair enough. So,
yeah. But I want you to want to flip it on its head, okay? And I'm intentional about that. So it's a good comment. Okay, let me just talk about basic communication. We talk about 6 points of interaction and communication. This will make sense in a moment. So she sends a message, he perceives a message, that message triggers off a meaning, an impact, some reaction. So then he sends a message back, and that triggers off her perception, and then that. So this is classic communication, all right? So she says something, I perceive it, I react, I go, la, 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 la. She looks at me like an idiot and says, what are you reacting for? This is what I meant. And what happens is most of the times we think we're communicating about words, but we're actually communicating about the red stuff, not the black stuff. All right? And I'll give you an example. Couples come into counselling and go, oh, we've got problems communicating. And she goes, blah, 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 he never. He rolls his arm, folds his arm. And then she goes, there you go again. And I go, you don't have a communication problem. Look at you. He folds his arm, rolls his eyes. You know exactly what he means. You don't have a problem with communication. Now, the untrained couples therapy will teach them communication skills, but the research says they walk out the door and don't use it because they communicate perfectly well. The problem is they're not communicating in a constructive way and they're not communicating about the important stuff, the stuff below the waterline. So what happens is that every time we have interaction, there's an impact and a meaning, and often that meaning is touched into my sense of worth. And same over here. And what we do is that we focus on the black zone so often rather than focusing on the red zone. So let me give you a classic example. Couples just had B-grade sex. No, let's make it worse than that. Z-grade sex. They've had Z-grade sex. He, up here, says to her, how was it for you, babe? Now, I'm going to say, okay, what's the meaning for him? Maybe he's feeling insecure and he needs her to say, sweetheart, that was really good sex. You moved the earth for me, so that he can feel good about his masculinity. So let's say that she goes, sweetheart, that was really great sex. What's going on for her? Oh, it's her job to stroke his ego. She doesn't want to upset him because she says, if I say to him, listen, that was Z-grade sex, it was terrible, he might get upset and roll over and be cranky with me. So now they've got a recipe for Z-grade sex for the rest of their married life. Because they can't be authentic and have transparency and intimacy. And what stops them is not the black zone, but the red zone. So imagine if she says, sweetheart, I love you, but that was crappy sex. And let's say that he has a bit of a tandy and a hissy fit, and she's actually able to stay okay with herself, and he gets through that, then they can talk about it. Now, this is what happens. So we have these if-thens, and I'm going to just give an example of this. So what happens? His belief is, she will only love me if I'm a stud or whatever. She won't accept me if she sees me as I really am. Remember I talked about the stuff we don't want to be seen? So what he does, he says, I will be the person that I think that she wants. I will present a pretend self that I think that she wants. The real self falls in the background. And what happens is, I know we're not deeply connected because I know I'm not sharing myself. But I can't share myself because I'm scared. Here's the truth. Authentic intimacy increases our anxiety. It doesn't increase our sense of safety. To actually be naked to the soul and allow somebody to see me like Christ sees me increases our anxiety. And we do this all the time. If I do this for you, then you'll be okay, or I'll do this for you because you need to see this. And then we end up with this conundrum, this puzzle, where we're just eternally insecure because I want her to really know me, but I won't let her know me because I'm going to give her the bloke I think she wants to see. Does it make sense? Then the next one is like this. You say that you love me, but I don't want to hurt you, but who I am is not what you really want. So I'm not going to show it to you. And then she says, what's wrong with me? No matter what I do, I can't please him. This is really normal patterns. And so when these start to happen, then the evil one pokes up his head and said, listen, I can meet your need for intimacy over here. I can fix it over here. And so then we move from where it should be to where it shouldn't be, because we're trying to meet a need because some stuff is not being sorted out properly. Some blokes do get a miracle and have that healing. A lot of blokes actually have to struggle because they have to address the need. You know, I was talking to him yesterday and he made a comment about a book he'd read and said, you know, this behaviour is a result of something that's a that. The question is, what is the that? And so, you know, what happens is that we're really good at trying to maybe address the porn issue, but we're not addressing the need or the that. So, you know, we're not dealing with the red zone. Porn can be in the black zone, but we're not actually dealing with the red zone. And tomorrow I'm going to talk about recovering from sexual brokenness and addressing some stuff. But what I want to do now first of all, I want to brainstorm. What are the issues? Porn is obviously one of the issues. And I'm just going to make a list of issues here, and then we're going to interact over some of those issues. So what do you think are the issues about sexuality in our culture that we face as blokes? All right. I'm going to address some specifics, and we'll have some time tomorrow as well to do some question and answer on this. And I'm going to steal a little bit of quad time because I think this is really important. But I wanted this slide up here because I think the first thing to understand is that, sex is not a need. Sex is not a need. Huh?
I like the flavor of it.
Yeah. But it's not a need. And I say to young people all the time when I'm in school, I say, if you think sex is a need, go without it and see how long it takes you to die. Nobody dies from not having sex. But as we talk now, there are people dying as a consequence of sex. Just the side letters you hear. Contraceptive issues, birth control issues. Pre the safe sex program, there were 8 major sexually transmitted diseases. 40 years on, we have 27. Many of those have long-lasting life conditions. And just as a sideline issue here, when AIDS hit the crisis in Africa, it reached its peak, the response from the United Nations and the US was to ship 200 million condoms into Africa. The result was AIDS increased, not decreased. I sat with Sister Miriam Duggan, who's a head of a order of Catholic nuns based in Ireland. She spent 30 years in Uganda under the reign of Idi Amin. When Idi Amin kicked out all the expats, her children liked Sister Miriam, and so she was allowed to stay. When she was training as a nun, they said, we need doctors, so she was trained in pediatrics, obstetrics and gynaecology. When she arrived in Uganda at the during the AIDS crisis, when she was in Uganda, is that amongst teenagers, 1/4 of teenagers had HIV/AIDS. 1 out of 4 kids. She, with another nun, started an education program called the ABC program, which was promoting abstinence, promoting about being faithful and about relying on your community to help you live that way. They used youth groups, so they used church, Islamic groups. It didn't matter if they were religious or non-religious. They got communities of young people and started talking about the ABC program. The ABC program, in about a 5-year period, reduced that rate to under 5%. It's currently under 4%. I asked Miriam, I said, why did you do this program? And she said, Peter, I sat on the end of the bed of a 15-year-old boy who looked me in the eyes and said, Doctor, I'm dying of AIDS. Why am I dying when I did what the government told me to do? I used a condom. We don't tell our young people the truth about condoms and safe sex, that it's actually safer sex. We don't talk about these facts. But what happens is we've cultivated a perception that sex is a need. And if I don't need it, somehow I'll die. But the fact is that people are actually dying from inauthentic sex, inauthentic sexual experiences, because we are reaping the consequences of that. Just as a sideline issue, and I'll come back to something else in a minute, the number one sexually transmitted disease amongst Australian teenagers is chlamydia. Chlamydia is a bacteria. What it does, it attaches on and it causes scarring of the fallopian tubes in the uterus. It can be treated with antibiotics. The number one cause for infertility in young Australian women is they've had chlamydia. In 80% of cases of chlamydia, it is asymptomatic. No signs, no symptoms. They don't know they've got it. For a woman with one case of chlamydia, 1 in 4 chance of never having children. A repeat case of chlamydia, 1 in 2 chance of not having kids. And our governments and our media say just use condoms. Well, condoms in prevention of chlamydia give you only, at best, 50% protection against chlamydia. More importantly, in America at the moment, the trend for young people with chlamydia is to say use condoms and see your doctor every year and take your antibiotics. But what they don't realise is that when a woman gets chlamydia, is that her immune system sends out all these antibodies to actually attack the chlamydia bacteria, and it takes an imprint of the protein in the DNA so that the immune system remembers when that bug is around. The protein in chlamydia is almost identical to the protein that is produced in a fetus. So later in life, when she gets pregnant and the blastocyst is in the fallopian tubes, is the immune system sends out antibodies to attack this baby and causes a spontaneous abortion. But we're not telling young people that, because young people need sex. So the truth is, nobody needs sex but we will die of the consequences of it, of inappropriate, inauthentic sex. And to answer your question before that you raised, is that sex is a want or a desire. It is the strongest drive in the human body. Now, let me just tackle one of the biggest myths around. The biggest myth is that men have a raging sex drive and women don't. Not true. What is true is that in every marriage, there is one with a high desire and one with a low desire, and it's got nothing to do with gender. Sometimes it's the woman who's got the high desire and the man's got the low desire, and sometimes it's the man with the high desire and sometimes it is the woman with the low desire. And the desire is not about libido. It is not about our physical body. It's actually about the meaning. It's all about the meaning that I put on sex. And so it's okay to go, I want sex. And I say generally, I want sex and I want sex this way. But I need to do that in a way that's not demanding, where I go, this is what I want, but if you don't want to give it to me, it is okay. I will not die. But most of us, when we're wound up like a two-bob watch, we think we're going to die. We're bought the myth about blue ball syndrome, which is a myth, but we're not going to die. And if I'm going to have authentic sexuality, do I want it to be something that is a gift given to me, or is it something that I want to demand? And so therefore, here's the bit. This is called wanting with maturity. That I can say, this is what I want from my relationship, but I want it to be a gift, and it's okay for you to make your own decision, because I won't die and I'll deal with me. That takes maturity. And dealing with the red zone is really important. But when I perceive that I need sex and I should demand sex and I should get sex, and if she says, well, no, buddy, I'm not doing it, then I might as well just go and take it wherever I can get it or whatever. And you start to see that how this interaction lays a foundation for some crappy choices. Is this making sense? There's a few guys nodding. Is this making sense? Give me a nod. Okay, good. So the first thing I want to say is that when I'm dealing with blokes who've got sexual addiction, is that rarely do I focus on the behaviour. I focus on the meaning. What's going on in the inside? Now, there are some behaviour things to do, because those who did my elective last year when we talked about porn and the impact on women, that there are neurological pathways. So when I actually engage in sex, I write neurological pathways. Now, if I've got sick pathways being fired off, is that the things that are going to arouse me are going to be sick things. So I have to change the meaning and I have to change the pathways. But to change the neurological pathways takes about 1,000 repetitions. So let me give you an example of this. I don't do any porn. I don't do even soft porn. So advertising, I'm very careful. When stuff comes up on SBS, I change channels. And the reason I do that is because that's somebody's daughter, and I don't want my daughters treated that way. That's somebody's wife or future wife, and I don't want my wife treated that way. So I don't do it. Secondly, I don't need to do it, because I've got a head full of fantasies of amazing sexual encounters with my wife that is about shared mutual meaning. So I don't need to fill my head with other junk. But I struggle with one porno image, is that I came home to the house that I was sharing with three other blokes when I was at teacher's college, and they were watching a porno, and I walked in and they said, oh, come on, Pete, sit down and watch this. I watched 5 minutes, and it's the 5 minutes that I regret in my life. Because at inappropriate times, those images come back into my brain. And I have to work really hard to take those thoughts captive and go, that is repulsive and wrong. I'm going to push that out and I'm going to replace it with something that is healthy and wholesome. That is hard work. But this is all about the meaning that's going inside my head, my heart, my gut, my whole being. It's got nothing to do with narrowly. Now, the first tip is that if I think the slightest that sex is a need and I get to demanding, then that demanding actually brings an expectation of entitlement. And I'm going to talk a bit about this tomorrow, is that men have amazing sexual control, But we don't talk about that, and I'm going to talk specifically about that, and then I've got a couple of illustrations for that. So the first thing is, it's got to be about the meaning. So whether it is the music industry, soft porn advertising, you know, I've got to tackle the meaning. Now, some of the things that will tackle the meaning. If I feel bad about myself, if I feel insecure, if I've got a fragile ego, I will look for something that makes me feel good, something that makes me feel strong and manly. And let me tell you, porn and sexual brokenness and sexual sin will do that very quickly. It's gratifying, it makes you feel good for a little bit of time. Then the guilt comes in. So what happens is the guilt comes in, and then I promise to God, I promise to myself, and so then I go, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do it, and I deprive myself, but I don't address the right issues. And then if I deprive myself long enough, then I'll actually indulge. So it's like, you know, packet of Tim Tams. No, I'm not eating the Tim Tams, I'm losing weight. And you have one Tim Tam, and then you end up eating the whole packet. And then you feel yuck and guilty and say, I'm never doing that again, and you just go through the same cycle again. It's what we call the dig cycle. And we're not addressing the need or the perceived need and what is real need and what's going on about how do I feel about me? Am I secure in myself? Do I like myself? Do I need to have sex to feel good about me? Do I need my woman to actually make me feel like I'm a strong man? See, this is part of the issues that is happening in a lot of these issues that we're dealing with in society. Let me pick up, I think, a really important one, and this is important for our young guys. Single guys and single again. Single again is really difficult. So if you all get divorced or your wife dies, you've been sexually active, so you go from actually being sexually active to zip. Anyone heard a sermon on that?
Never.
Maybe we need to. Because there are women who struggle with this too. So let me first of all talk about the single guys. First of all, what we know from research is that about 95 to 99% of guys masturbate during puberty, and the other 5% are probably lying about it. And yet, as Christian blokes, we grow up with an enormous amount of guilt. Now, let me give a historical context to this, because this is very, very important to understand. If we went back even 100 years ago, 100 years ago, puberty happened a little later, so puberty could have been around 15, and you were married by 17. So the period of adolescence where you had sexual awakening and no sexual behaviour was only a couple of years. That's easy to manage. But what happens now, puberty starts as young as 10. The average age for getting married in Australia is 28. So now we have this 18-year period to manage. But we don't factor that in when we're talking in from the church about how do we manage adolescent sexuality, whereas we've actually got a social change where now, managing your sexuality for 2 years is a bit different from managing it for 18. And so we need to actually talk about what you do with that. So, one, I always say, and, you know, I said this yesterday, masturbation is morally neutral because the Bible doesn't address it. But there are a couple other principles the Bible gives us, which is the principle of love. So, can there be a thing of masturbation that doesn't violate love? Yes, I think there is. But when masturbation violates love and mutuality, so mutual respect, there's a problem. So the context, the red zone stuff of masturbation is important. Why am I masturbating? What's going on in my head? And what's it attached to? Now, I always say this to young people. Masturbating with pornography or pornographic fantasy, I think, is wrong. I think that defies love and mutuality. But I know of guys who have been married with a spouse with prolonged illness. And, you know, as part of their managing their sexualities, they've masturbated because they actually want to take pressure off their wife, or they're really struggling. Some guys have the capacity to go, I don't need to masturbate. Some guys can't. They go, I know, this is driving me nuts. And so I think there is a time and a place when masturbation is okay, but it's about why and what's attached to it. And does it violate the principle of love and mutuality? Now, that actually makes it harder, not easier, because now you've got to wrestle with yourself and go, what's going on in here and in here if I do this? And so I say to young guys is that, boys, you're going to probably masturbate at some stage, but don't put it with pornography. Stay away from pornography. It's absolute evil. Absolute evil. And just, you know, any of our young blokes here, if you, you know, are being caught up in this, talk to somebody. If you're not sure, let me just give you a sideline issue here. Interesting, the correlation of the proliferation of pornography on the internet coincides with a medication called Viagra. Put those two together for a moment. Here, what we know from research. Porn addicts have higher levels of sexual dysfunction than others, higher levels of ejaculatory dysfunction. Because part of what they're doing is they're using this stimulation to fire off their system, and so therefore as they actually need more stimulation, and they're actually not using the healthy stimulation. Sexual arousal is an anxiety-like trigger measure. And so something that is naughty or bad or wrong has a high anxiety component to it, to arousal. But let me tell you, authentic intimacy can never be matched by that stuff. Because authentic intimacy increases your anxiety. It doesn't make you feel safe. It makes it risky. And that actually is really good for a healthy sex life. So let me just give you one practice for the married guys. Try having sex with the lights on and look into your wife's eyes and maintain eye contact with her through orgasm. Yeah. Yeah. Because a lot of people don't want to be seen. They don't want to be seen. And so before that is then you can do a thing of what we call hugging to relax. Okay, so stand up.
Well, you can have it in the day.
I'll get to that in a moment. So,
hang on.
That is one of the benefits of retirement, isn't it, Watto? Yeah, yep. And one of the benefits from working from home and having my wife be my practice manager, okay? All right.
Working for yourself.
Working for yourself, okay? Hugging till you relax is what you do. Is if you're going to hug your wife, okay, is that you stand on your own feet. Don't, you know, most people hug and they sort of lean in on one another. Don't, stand on your feet.
Support me.
Stand on your own feet and then hug, but hug so you can look in the eyes and just stay there until she's ready to pull away. And when she's ready to pull away, just take a big breath. Okay? And so you learn to hug and look into her eyes, but stand on your own feet and you watch, because there'll be a point when you want to pull away, and when you want to pull away, something's happening in your red zone. And when they want to pull away, there's something happening in their red zone. But you don't fix their red zone. This is the beauty of it. I cannot address anything in Nerilee's red zone. I can only address it in mine. So meaning is everything. So whether, you know, how do I actually build meaningful connected sex is actually not about just having an orgasm. All right? It's actually about connection. And so as you said, you know, the difficulties of climaxing because of the physiology stuff, but that doesn't mean you're not connecting, right? Yes, there's a diminished thing, but it actually, as much as that's a pain in the bum and a disappointment, it actually doesn't take away from the meaningful connection. And Kevin Lehman's book, Sex Begins in the Kitchen, is right. You know, stand in the kitchen and do the dishes with her and look at her and talk to her. And we'll talk a bit more about this tomorrow, but see, our culture makes it all about bodies and externals and needs. That is us about. It's totally back to front. So for singles and singles again, I think we need to actually wrestle with, if I'm going to masturbate, what's in the red zone for me? And is this stopping me from connection? Because the problem with habitual addictive masturbation is that I learn to connect with myself and I don't connect with others. And the pornography does that too. And therefore what happens is that using this other stimulation is going to result in physical health issue. Let me just pick up the cohabitating, and I'll throw a little bit in about the same sex in this one as well. The current battle for the redefinition of marriage is a really, really important battle, because when we actually hear nice statements about equality, we're actually not engaging in the debate well. And parliamentarians, my local parliamentarian, cops an earful from me every time I see him. Marriage by nature is exclusive. Okay? To be eligible to marry, you have to want to marry somebody of the opposite sex who's not closely related to you and who's of the age of consent. So if a brother and a sister say they love each other, they're not allowed to get married. It's exclusive. If you're already married, you can't get married again. It's exclusive. So this is nonsense when we talk about equity. Second thing is that we need to actually start to, why is the premise of marriage being exclusive, and why has marriage received a special consideration throughout the ages across all Western cultures? Very important. Now, why have we stopped brothers and sisters getting married? Because there are, it's unwise, there's harm. So the question needs to be asked, does cohabitating bring harm? Does same-sex marriage bring harm? Now, there's a body of research, because we have countries that have had same-sex marriage for 10 years. And for anybody who's cohabitating, this is not a judgment. I respect everybody's right, because God respects everybody's free will. Therefore, I expect everybody's right to choose to do what they want to do with their life. But to say that that's the same as marriage is nonsense. The research in Australia, couples who live together and before they get married have twice the amount of domestic violence as those who don't. When they do get married, they have twice the divorce rate of those who don't. And in Britain, where they cohabitate, where the children belong to mum, but the boyfriend is not the father of the kids, the rates of child abuse are 20 times greater than traditional families. So I argue on the premise of doing no harm that it's not the best choice. But if you wish, do it. Now let's take gay marriage or gay same-sex civil unions. In Scandinavia, where there's been same-sex marriage for 10 years, less than 6% of the gay community actually take it up. Now, the gay community in Australia is 1.3% of our population, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics. And of that 1.3, only 6% in the other countries take it up. In terms of divorce, gay men's marriage in those countries have an 80% higher divorce rate than regular marriage, and gay women have 150% higher divorce rate. We know the impact of divorce on kids. So now we want to make it into a structure that is actually flawed in its makeup, that's going to create more social cost and harm. Domestic violence. The couple type with the most domestic violence are lesbians. They have the highest head and shoulders above. The couple type with the least amount of domestic violence, traditional marriage. But you're not going to hear these stats out there. And mind you, the lobby groups know them. They just work hard to avoid them. So forget Christianity for a moment. On the premise of doing no harm, there are some choices that put people at risk of greater harm. And I've got to tell you, I've counseled gays, lesbians, I've counseled them. I got to tell you, lesbians are a really nasty bunch of bitches sometimes. They really are. I wouldn't want to be treated how sometimes they treat their partners. I've heard the stories. And the crazy thing... Yeah, I do. And then I have to actually manage it in my head and go, this is gross, nobody should hear this. So I want to come back to one about love and lust. Love is driven about my perceived need. I need this. It's all about me. Lust is about that. Lust is all about me. Love is actually about, you know what? I can bring the best of me to you and I want to meet with you when you want to meet with me. And said to me yesterday, he had a thought when we're talking about wall socket sex, electric sex. He had this thought, and it was brilliant. I said, I have to use that. He said, maybe single-phase electricity is all about me, and three-phase electricity is about her, me, and God. Isn't that good? Isn't that gold? So let's not settle for electric sex that's single-phase. Let's go for three-phase. And so there's a huge difference. But see, the biggest sex organ in my body is my brain, because it makes up for 90% of what happens sexually. And so this meaning stuff, the red zone stuff, is all in my brain, and that actually then connects with my heart and my guts and putting it all together. And so I need to change my thinking around that. Let me just pick up the issue of menopause, because I know there's a few blokes struggling with wives with menopause, and narrowly, you know, being freight trained into menopause, and it makes a difference. And sometimes for women with menopause, they have a terrible, terrible time. And the first thing I say is that dealing with menopause is we need to apply grace and understanding. The second thing we need to do is that we need to actually encourage our wives and even go with them to go and see a doctor who's savvy about this. Some doctors know nothing about it. But if you find a GP who's really savvy, there is so much that can be done. Now, for Nerilee's menopause, it's actually medication-induced. There's not much that can be done about it. But you know what? She's on this medication for 5 years. We've got a bit over 2 years to go. It's not the end of the world. It really isn't. But for some people, it's actually really torturous. And if they actually get to a medical practitioner, there's a lot that can be done, probably for 95% of cases. But the worst thing to do for a guy whose wife's going menopause is, oh, you're just menopausal. She's going to smack you one, kick you out of the bed probably for 6 months. Whereas if I can actually maybe hug her, stand on my feet and go, I really love you, I'm really concerned about what's going on. Can we talk about this? And have an invitational posture. See, this is all about being invited. When I let you know what I want, I'm doing that in an invitational way. So it changes my attitude to the interaction, which is actually much more inviting. I'm going to leave it there. What I'm going to do, I'm going to tidy up my list. And I'll have a look through tonight, and tomorrow I'll try to pick up as many of those as I can, and then we'll talk about recovering from sexual brokenness and relational brokenness. Is that cool? Okay. Thank you. So let's pray together. Father God, thank you that we've got a forum here where we can be just honest. For many of us, we've not had a space where we can just say it as it is. And Lord, we do want to acknowledge that sex and sexuality is a wonderful gift given by you to bless our lives. But yet, for many of us, it's a source of pain, frustration, regret, shame. And it's not meant to be that way. So Lord, I want to pray for my brothers that they will open up and share with other blokes, so that regret can be real and shame can be cut out, and that the freedom and your grace can permeate in, so that we can start to reclaim our sexuality and see it transform in the way that we interact with one another and particularly with our women. So guide us and give us incredible wisdom and courage to be transparent and authentic. I pray in your name, Jesus. Amen.